Broadcasting from the United States Institute of Peace in Washington, D.C., welcome to The Peace Frequency, a podcast series searching for ways to create a world free of violent conflict and finding them in the stories of people across the globe who are making peace possible. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge. On today's show, we continue our series covering 60 days of engagement around youth, gender, and peace. For those of you who are new to this 60 days of engagement, here is what it's all about. In mid-August, the world began celebrating a series of three important days. August 12th was International Youth Day. September 21st was the International Day of Peace. And coming up on October 11th is the International Day of the Girl Child. These are all days recognized and celebrated around the world through the 60 Days of Engagement series on the Peace Frequency. We are bringing increased attention to how young people are integral to peacebuilding and how peacebuilding work is made stronger and more effective when viewed and understood through a gendered lens. USIP, along with a number of other organizations, are hosting events, spreading awareness, and providing educational opportunities that touch on these three themes of youth peace and gender equality, that touch on these 3 days of celebration and how they intersect. Joining me in the studio for today's podcast is my guest, Mark Summers. Mark is a visiting researcher with the African Studies Center at Boston University. He is an internationally recognized expert on youth concerns in war and post-war countries. His most recent book is entitled The Outcast Majority: War, Development, and Youth in Africa, published by University of Georgia Press. You can find his book through online retailers like Amazon, and you can follow Mark on Twitter at Mark Summers. That's spelled MarkSummers, at Mark Summers. So, Mark, thanks for being on the podcast today.
Great to be here, Darren.
I'm also joined in the studio by one of my USIP colleagues, Aubrey Cox. Aubrey is a senior program specialist who manages the Generation Change Program, which works with young leaders across the globe to foster collaboration, build resilience, and strengthen capacity as they transform local communities. Aubrey is going to be following the questions and comments from the audience, all of you, throughout the show. And that means that if you are listening from around the world, we invite you to share your questions and comments with us during the podcast, during this conversation. If you're listening to this broadcast on the Peace Frequency webpage, you can post your questions and comments in the discussion forum at the bottom of the page. You can also tweet us your questions using the hashtag YouthPeaceEquality. Again, that's hashtag YouthPeaceEquality, and that's the official hashtag that we've been using throughout the 60 days of engagement. So start thinking about your questions and comments now. We're talking about youth. We're talking about gender and peace and the importance of all that intersecting, and we want to bring you into this conversation. And when you do send us a tweet or post in the forum, make sure you tell us from where in the world you are listening. So with that, let's get started. Now, Mark, we start all of our podcasts with something I call the behind the bio question. This is a question that in your response hopefully reveals something about your personality, your motivations, your inspirations, something that we wouldn't normally find in a bio that we come across Googling your name online. And so I actually have two of them for this episode. And the first one is a question that we actually posed on social media as part of our 60 days of engagement. And that question is, who is someone of a gender different than your own that you look up to or view as a role model?
I'm thinking of two people, two women. One is Jane Geyer, who was one of my advisors in graduate school at Boston University. And she really, as a professional anthropologist, which is my training, really helped me understand not only to do my work with integrity, but also to have a sense of social responsibility. And so she really was a model for doing my work. She also is an Africanist and a very creative intellect. So someone I really admire and have really looked up to since I was figuring out how to do work in this profession. The second person is Mary Diaz, who had passed away a few years ago. She was the head of the Women's, what was then called the Women's Commission for Refugee Women and Children. And I worked for the commission for about 3 years as their what was it, child and adolescent specialist. And Mary was so well-spoken and had a knack for talking about difficult issues with powerful people in a way that was not threatening. And I really learned a lot just going to briefings with her and going to meetings with her. She was really an impressive woman, and I carry around a lot that I learned from her.
Difficult issues with powerful people. Yes, I wish more people had that gift. Can you remember one of those difficult issues and some of those powerful people that where you saw her in action?
Yeah, I mean, we had a lot of discussions with UN High Commissioner for Refugees, and I was asked to go into situations where there were, you know, the impact of war on children and adolescents. So I was going into refugee camps, for example, from Sierra Leone. And in talking about those findings, they were tough about UNHCR and about the refugee situation, about protection issues. And she did it in a way that was sort of balancing being empathic to the refugees, the adolescents and children, as well as women, and at the same time having some empathy for UNHCR. And so what that engendered was a really useful discussion that we had with UNHCR, because it was tricky stuff to talk about. The situation was terrible. This was during the war, in the middle of the Civil War in Sierra Leone in maybe 1997, 98. And they had to really sort of admit to how bad it was, but also we wanted to work with them to think of what the solutions were. And so they weren't so defensive. It was really a constructive meeting. Mm-hmm. So
thanks for sharing, that. You're also a blues man. You were here at USIP a few weeks ago doing a book talk, and it was revealed that you are a blues man. You've been studying blues. And so I've wanted to ask you this ever since you were here, if you could go on tour with any blues artist, living or dead, who would that artist be and why?
Oh, probably Muddy Waters. I saw him many, many times. In fact, I used to sneak into bars when I was a kid living in Chicago, and I just found him to be so extraordinary as a singer, and as a kind of a showman as well. So, I think that one of the things about Muddy is there's a lot of repetition of lines in blues. I don't think I ever heard Muddy Waters sing the same line the same way. He was a singer. There are very few singers as great as Muddy Waters that I've ever heard. Wow. So,
if you had to recommend one song for the blues novice from Muddy Waters to get them immersed into his brilliance, what would that one song be?
Well, there's so many, but I'm going to just say "Mannish Boy" because it talks about we can pick up on that, because I used to play that song in class. Because of the sort of the gender reference, that here's a man who at that time was 65, 70 years old and had this song called "I'm a Man, Isn't That a Man?" And it was pretty obvious he was a man. But that is a theme, this issue of masculinity and constantly having to prove it, which comes up in Mannish Boy in a kind of a wonderful way.
That's great. I just listened to that on YouTube the other day because I was going back and watching your book talk, and you mentioned Mannish Boy. And I said, let me go back and listen to this song. So to our listeners out there, Google Mannish Boy, Muddy Waters, give it a listen. Maybe it'll have new meaning to you after this interview. Great. Well, thanks for sharing all that, Mark. Let's go back a little bit in your story. You were once the headmaster of a girls' school in Kenya. Can you take us back to that moment in your life? When was that, and why did you decide that this was something that you wanted to do?
I had this determination when I was a teenager that I wanted to go and live in Africa. And I think it came from spending so much time looking in National Geographic magazines. And I just made this decision as a youngster that that's what I wanted to do. I found out that you could teach in a school in Kenya, teach English in a school is what I thought I would do. If you sort of connected directly to the school or to a set of schools. And so I did that and I...
How old were you? When was this?
I was 23.
Okay.
So I got out of undergrad and I worked for a year and saved money and then off I went. And where I ended up was a school that was very small and it was a girls' high school and they needed a new headmaster. And since I had a bachelor's degree, they said that I needed to be the headmaster, and I said, I don't want to be the headmaster. I'm only 23 years old. How can I be the headmaster of a high school?
Had you ever been to Kenya or the African continent?
No, no. I'd done a lot of traveling in India, and okay. I'd been to Mexico, but I had never been to Africa.
Okay.
So they said they couldn't ever hire someone not because of my age, but because of my degree. So they could never get somebody to be a boss over me because of my degree. So I gave it a hard thought. I said, I'll let you know in the morning. So I thought about it and decided to do that. And it was a real life changing experience for me because there I was, running a secondary school for girls and, introduced to me not only the issues of youth, but the issues of gender in a very powerful way. And I had to really battle some of the parents to keep their daughters in school and to not not to beat them when they did something wrong. So we were very successful at our little school. We had good teachers, really dedicated teachers, and great students. So it was quite an experience.
You were 23 years old, and it's different for different people, but I feel like that's in an age range where you're also still trying to figure out and come to grips with your own manhood and what it means. So the fact that you're 23, the headmaster of a girls' secondary school in Kenya, dealing with and being exposed to all these gender issues, did that transform at all how you viewed your own manhood?
Well, first of all, how to be a headmaster when you're 23. The headmaster of the primary school that it was connected to was kind of my mentor on what to do and how to handle things. And there were a lot of people who wanted to give me advice, but he was really quite helpful. On the sort of becoming a man, it was strange because since I was a headmaster, even though I was so young, I was seen as a man in the village. And so when there was a funeral, I sat with the men and was really recognized as one. I was never very comfortable with that, but I had to play the part. And I remember my two women teachers pulled me aside and said that I had to act much more grown up because the students needed that, to sort of grown up in the sense of acting much more like a much older man. And so to be a little more remote than I was. And I was uncomfortable being a headmaster at such a young age. When we had repeating students, one was 21.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I took the advice from the primary school headmaster and my two teachers and I think actually when I look back at it, I think it did help sort of thinking about myself as a man.
What or who do you remember most from that experience? I mean, you just mentioned the headmaster of the primary school, so perhaps that's one person. But how did that experience or that person shape the work you're doing today? Do you still see some of that experience being the headmaster of the school coming back into how you're thinking about things or perceiving things in the work that you're doing today, the writing and the books that you're putting out?
Well, one thing was the students, young people always surprise you. I mean, it's they can always do more than you think. And I found with so many of my students that they had a level of maturity and depth of sort of thinking, analysis that really I found surprising. Just a high level of maturity in these young Kenyan girls or young women, which was really remarkable to me. One thing that happened is we got used books from America to start the first library in this area that they'd ever had. So we started it at the school, and the students loved books so much they wouldn't come out for recess ever. They would just sit. Myself and the teachers had to force them out to get a little exercise, because they, as soon as the class was over, you know, biology or whatever, they would pick up their books. And there was one young girl named Damari, and she loved Alice in Wonderland, and she read it over and over. And I tried to talk to her. There are other books. We have lots of books. No, no. Alice in Wonderland was for her, and she used to read that. She didn't have any shoes except her father's. She had these huge kind of formal shoes that her father had given her, or that she, you know, borrowed from her father. And she was a very small, thin woman or girl, and she used to read Alice in Wonderland over and over again. Uh-huh. I still remember that.
Wow. You're listening to The Peace Frequency, a podcast series searching for ways to create a world free of violent conflict and finding them in the stories of people across the globe who are making peace possible. My guest on today's show is Mark Summers. He is a visiting researcher at the African Studies Center at Boston University, internationally recognized expert on youth concerns in war and post-war countries, and his most recent book is titled The Outcast Majority: War, Development, and Youth in Africa, published by the University of Georgia Press. So I want to turn to your most recent book, Mark, again called The Outcast Majority. Folks can find it online, Amazon, other retailers. This is a tough question because you've done all the research, you've written this book, and don't take it as an insulting question, but what's the main argument of your book if you had to distill it down into a few sentences? What's the main argument that you want people to walk away with when they read your book?
Well, let me answer that in a couple of ways. The first one is, the motivation for writing the book was having worked in this field for so long, this field known as, I don't know, youth in conflict, post-conflict, or just development and reconstruction sort of more broadly. It was very clear to me that the approach to youth issues was never, ever, ever, ever going to work. And it was quite frustrating to have an awareness of that and not having a chance to really have a big discussion about how to make development and our responses to young people more effective. So I fortunately got some money from the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars here in D.C. to start the book. And so the book is really divided into what happens to youth during wars, and what kinds of larger issues that they face. And then I look at how development approaches youth issues, and there's such an enormous, vast gap between the two. And then the end of the book ends with a framework for how to bridge that gap. So that's kind of the structure of the book. But the idea of the book and the idea of the title, actually, yeah, comes from an irony, which is sort of the starting point for the book, which is that youth might be dominant in a demographic way in terms of their numbers, but most of them act as if they're members of an outcast minority. And so the big challenge we have is not the numbers of youth, it's their alienation.
I was just listening on the news this morning. Robert Mugabe is, I think it's his 92nd birthday today or something, or he's 92 yeah. years old. And the reporter said, you know, how many people living in Zimbabwe now were not even born when he first took power and was seen as this, you know, liberation type figure, because he's been in power for 30 plus years at this point. And so when you talk about the demographics in terms of the youth population around the world, in some instances they've grown up only knowing, you know, one leader, yet still like you said, perceive themselves as a minority voice perhaps in some of these contexts.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true. I think one of the most overused and misapplied concepts in development is community. Community in sort of development training, the implication is it's in a rural area. And it's with you. A community is kind of has elders, and it has women's leaders, and it has leaders of this and leaders of that, and they all get together. And the implication is that a community is functional. First of all, a lot of people live in cities, and community looks different in cities than it does in rural areas. And secondly, a lot of young people feel they don't belong to any of these, what we imagine as communities. And in fact, that's correct. They don't belong. I think one of the things we have to do is look at how we're sort of framing the issues, because it's not with reference to young people quite often, even when they're the most people around.
All right. Now, you are an Africanist, and mm-hmm. I think a lot of your research and most of the research for this book took place throughout the African continent.
That's
where
correct.
Did the research for this book take you? What countries were you doing this research?
Well, what I tried to do in the book is to draw from interviews with young people and people, members of civil society and African governments and international development people, but mainly youth in places that I'd conducted research. So I guess some of the places would be in Central Africa, Rwanda, Burundi, DRC, and in West Africa, Liberia and Sierra Leone, South Sudan. And then I also a lot of different countries that where I was with refugees like Kenya and Tanzania and Uganda and Gambia and Guinea. So I drew from that research and also read a lot and drew from a lot of different documents and a research so I could bring in the context of many other war, post-war situations as well. So it's pretty broad coverage.
I think one of the things that people find particularly challenging about writing around this topic or just developing programs around this topic is the sensitivity that comes with doing a conflict analysis, asking people, particularly young people, questions about how war and violence has impacted their lives. They've experienced trauma themselves. There still may be very much a dynamic of conflict going on, so there's sensitive issues. You've got to know what to ask about, what not to ask about, how to ask about it. I'd love for you to share with us a little bit about how you've developed the skill to draw out from people the kind of information that you're looking for to provide this analysis or to come up with or find some of these solutions. How do you speak with people to do that?
Well, it's regularly, and I mean regularly, young people say, "You're the first person who ever asked me what I thought." Young people are generally told what to do. And the first thing you do is never do a focus group unless it's a youth group that really wants to meet you. The problem with focus groups is that they're artificial and they have a structure. You think you're talking to 20 or 30 people and you're only talking to the few elites sitting next to you, near you, who do all the talking. And to assume that everybody in the room agrees with them is a huge mistake. It's an enormous distortion. There's often a lot of I found in talking to people later, well, why didn't you say anything? Well, I'm not supposed to talk. I don't agree. I can't say anything. We were told what to say before you came. So I avoid those. It's one of the things I try to do is to create an environment that's empowering for the person I'm going to talk to. So if it's male youth or female youth, often I ask them to set up the meeting. They decide where the meeting will be held. We agree on a time, and they decide who's going to be at that meeting. Now, for female youth, this is really important because it's unusual for them to have an interview with myself or myself and a translator. It's much more usual for them to have what I what are, I call peer groups. Peer group interviews are really powerful. And I think in war and post-war situations where things can get quite touchy, people want to tell you things quite often, but, you know, they're sensitive issues. If you're with your peers, it's not it's somehow easier to do. Now, the second thing I do is try to start off with empowering questions and to start to set the tone right away that they're the experts and I'm just the person there writing everything down. So often opening with questions like, so what's the situation of youth in your area? And then they become the experts in describing that, and that's a great starting point for a discussion.
Have you ever waded into difficult or uncomfortable territory? And how do you pick up those signals where, you know, you ask a question about perhaps a political situation or some taboo topic and it shuts down?
Yeah, it's happened not that often, but it has happened. I generally try to know context before I go into sensitive environments to do research, to do interviews. But there are times when that happens. What happens more often, though, is that people bring up issues. They want to share issues that actually for them it's a pretty risky thing to do. But, you know, in a lot of societies in the world, it's dangerous for people to talk about things themselves. And so they want that information to come out. And the way to do it is to give it to someone like me. Now, when you do research, you have to look at yourself in the mirror, I think, and say, okay, what are my strengths and weaknesses? I happen to be a white man. In some environments, that can be seen. There can be identification of me as a powerful person. And so they can give me this information and I can give it to the big people in their country. I make a promise if I can keep it that I will relay that information and that I can't guarantee what will happen. And I try my darndest to live up to that promise so that I will share messages and not say who they are. Quite often I don't know who they are even because I don't write down their names. And that's just to protect the people that give me the information. Mm-hmm.
During your book talk here, you talked about the assumption that too many people hold that youth, the word youth, is synonymous with young men, and that young men are to be feared, particularly young men from Africa and the Middle East.
That's right.
How do you see this assumption playing out in everyday culture, politics, and media, and why do you think this assumption exists?
Because we're afraid of them, and that would not just be people from the West looking at Africa or the Middle East. And it isn't just Africa and the Middle East. It seems to be heightened in those areas for two reasons. Number one, that's where the youth bulge is, and so that's where the huge populations of young people are.
And what is the youth bulge?
The youth bulge is this idea that there's an unusually high number of young people in the adult population. It's an interesting term. It came from the mid-80s from a demographer working in the security field here in the United States, the image that it implies is that there's something wrong, that it's unsteady, that right, it's a bulge. A bulge could burst, right? A bulge is not a good shape, and so right away you get the sense that something's wrong if you have too many young people, and so there's a lot of discomfort that governments have with huge youth populations, and that in the international community, I think it's very much the same thing. Youth, large numbers of youth makes people uncomfortable. Now, male youth live very public lives in general. Female youth do not in general, not always, but in general. And there's this belief that if you have too many unemployed youth, male youth, that they're going to cause trouble. There's no evidence of this, but there is not solid evidence. There are correlations that show if you have lots of youth, then instability goes up. But the implication of that is that most youth are the cause of instability. Even during a war, tiny, tiny fractions of youth get involved in violence. So it's a distortion. You know, it's like saying, since most criminals are male youth, then most male youth are criminals. No, no, and no. That's not true. But that's kind of the thinking. And I think what drives all of this, this focus on male youth, is we're afraid of them. And also, frankly, most governments have no idea what to do about the youth challenge that in their country. And they often don't feel very comfortable with young people. I mean, these are old people. Robert Mugabe is 92. And then they're most of their citizens are from a very young generation. And I think it's an uncomfortable situation in times of democracy. Quite often what youth say is they want our vote and then they forget about us afterwards. So there's an inherent tension there, and it does get focused on male youth because of the security dimension, which again is a total distortion. Most youth don't get involved, male or female, in violence. Most youth resist engagement in violence. We just don't look at that because we're not afraid what the thing that we're afraid of. Now, the issue of youth and being seen as male came out of interviews with practitioners in the development world. We talked about what does it really mean when you say gender or youth was a discussion. And what came out of these interviews was gender meant adult woman and youth meant male youth. As a matter of fact, one donor official said, if male youth aren't in a youth program, it's not a youth program. So what does this mean? It means female youth are invisible. They're not there. Or they're very, very ignorable, disregarded. And that's – I think we should all be troubled by that. Mm-hmm. And we need to change that.
You know, as you were talking about these misperceptions of youth, and you were talking earlier about particularly male youth as something to be feared, it reminded me, we did a podcast many, many, many months ago with Dominic Barter. He's a restorative justice practitioner, lives in Brazil. And he said something, it's not a direct quote, but he talked about the importance when trying to create community to walk towards what we fear, as opposed to walk away from what we fear. And when we walk away from what we fear, it creates that distance and furthers that misperception, because we don't want to learn about that person or that community over there that we fear. We want to get away from it. We don't want to see it. And that further creates the problem. And I feel like your work, and you know, correct me if I'm not hearing this correctly, but I feel like your work and the research that you've done, the books that you've written, to challenge this perception that young men are to be feared, you know, you've taken it upon yourself to, I'm going to walk towards that. I'm going to immerse myself in that. You know, if there's whatever, a group of young men sitting on the side of a street corner, some people might say, oh, I'm going to walk to the other side and I want to get away from that, or I want to get away from the street. It seems like you're someone that's like, you know what, I'm going to walk into that street. I'm going to walk towards, you know, those group of boys or men. And it's revealed a lot. So, I want to unpack that a little bit with you about this sense of walking towards what you fear. Do you, or have you at any point in any of the research that you've done, the work that you've done around the world, felt that fear, had that assumption yourself? Those are young men over there. They look like they don't have a job. They're up to no good. I'm scared. I might get hurt or injured or robbed or whatever. But you've had to push through that to essentially reinforce the point that you're making here, that young men are not to be feared, at least not in the way that most people think they are.
I haven't really thought about that. I am struck by, even going into very, very poor areas in cities, in general, if you do it right, it isn't scary at all. I think it's you can't go into a place like that by yourself and just walk around, because everybody's going to think like, who the hell are you? What are you doing here? I'm not going to talk to you. But if you have some connection to give you entree, that's different. And quite often you have to go to the government officials first and say, I'd like to work here, and so that they are not suspicious of you, because you can get people in trouble just if you don't get the clearance from local government officials. So it's a question of winning people over and then getting some sort of somebody who can give you entree, a religious leader, a civil society person. What was it? We were on 72nd Boulevard in Monrovia. There was a program that was going to open up for ex-combatants, and these guys were some of the toughest kids I've ever met. In a way, none of them were threatening at all. When they found out that there was an American guy who wanted to hear their stories, there was a huge line. I had to buy a case of soda because it was so hot. And then we went through that. I had to buy another case of soda. It was very popular. I had two Liberian colleagues that were with me that were setting up this program. And what they were telling them was so real and so vivid that they had to take turns translating from Liberian English, which I don't really understand, because too much of the war was coming back in the stories from these kids. You can't be stupid and naive about it, but there are ways to do this. The other thing that happens, which I find interesting, is, you know, for research purposes, I like to go several days, hopefully at least a week, to the same neighborhood. And that breaks down a lot. I mean, then they think, you know, by the third day they say, hey, you know, Mr. Mark, you know, what I told you on Monday? No, I was lying. So let me tell you what really was going on. So there's a lot of that goes on because nobody ever does that. It's very easy for a researcher to stand out because the experience of young people with foreigners is so narrow and usually not very helpful and not very inspiring for them. It's usually a disappointment. That to go beyond that is actually very easy. And you have to be sincere. You have to hang out with people. It's fun.
You're listening to The Peace Frequency, a podcast series searching for ways to create a world free of violent conflict and finding them in the stories of people across the globe who are making peace possible. My guest on today's show is Mark Summers. He's a visiting researcher at the African Studies Center at Boston University. He's an internationally recognized expert on youth concerns in war and post-war countries. And his most recent book is entitled The Outcast Majority, War, Development, and Youth in Africa, published by the University of Georgia Press. You can find his book through online retailers, and you can follow him on Twitter at Mark Summers. I want to go into gender identities. You said something at your book talk here that I feel triggered a lot of inner dialogue amongst folks who are in the room, and it was, I think this is a, you said that masculine identity is a fragile identity. Can you elaborate on that, and what do you mean by an identity being fragile?
Well, I made that comment with reference to femininity, and I think there's no question about it. I mean, I think femininity is so grounded. You know, I don't think there's a religion in the world where there's a concept of a father earth, mother earth. It's a centered idea, you know, in sort of cosmological terms or in religious terms. The feminine identity, the feminine quality in all of us has to do with nurturing and of course for a girl becoming a mother, being a vehicle of life, right, giving birth. So there's a centeredness that femininity has that grounds it. Now, for masculinity has to be sort of shaped and controlled quite often in traditionally by culture itself, by society itself. So it's a different kind of identity. And then you have all over the world, really, these expectations of being a man that are absolutely impossible for most males to achieve or to hold on to in a steady way. So you have this idea that, that traditionally in Africa, you often have to build a house or have a lot of cattle, pay a bride price sometimes, and marry in a church or a mosque in a real official public way. It takes a lot of money. That's hard to do. And the chances of male youth being able to do that increasingly are almost impossible. I mean, it's very few youth in a lot of countries proportionally can ever do that. 5% maybe, 10%. Some are so aware of it, and I find this in, particularly in West Africa, they don't even try. It's beyond possibility. So it puts you as a male youth. It puts you in a situation where you're being looked on as a failure quite often, which is really a humiliating condition. Then you have these broader ideas of masculinity that sort of go across the world, which is men are invulnerable to being ill or to being weak physically. You can't cry. You can't go to a doctor. You have to be this fantastic lover by the time you're 13, right? How? I don't know. But this is so there are all these expectations that are very unrealistic. And so you can – what happens with men is you can be sort of a man. Or, you know, are you a man and then you lose your job? Are you still a man? Sort of. Not – you don't really feel as much as a man would feel if they had a job, if they were able to take care of their kids, if their children could do whatever. They have to be the provider. They have to be the protector increasingly in the world. That's just not possible. So you have a fragility with being a man or reaching towards manhood that doesn't seem to apply. Now, I'm talking in very general terms, but it doesn't seem to apply in such a severe way as it does with the idea of femininity and womanhood, which is a little more basic and a little, as I said, it's generally speaking more grounded. So one of the great tragedies of this sort of unsteady masculinity, the threat of emasculation, is violence. Is that it all over the world? The outcome, the response is for the outlet for failed men or threatened men or emasculated men is to use violence in response, which of course doesn't help them or anybody else.
Interesting.
And, yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
We're all trapped by emasculation, it seems to me.
Do you feel this fragility is something that's relatively that masculine identity has become increasingly fragile over these past couple of generations, and that 200, 300 years ago, it was a little bit more of a stable identity? Or do you think it's always been at this state of fragility?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think that's such a broad question for humanity to think about. What I can say about my research for Outcast Majority is that it's just increasingly difficult for most male youth in Africa to reach, to meet the expectations of manhood, to be socially recognized as a man. And so I think some of that has to do with demographics. And these traditions are make it almost impossible. And keep in mind, it's not just boys, right? If a fundamental part of womanhood in Africa is getting married, well, what if there's no one to marry? That's usually the case. One of the functions of polygamy today or child marriage today is that there aren't other people to marry. It doesn't excuse either of those. But in the broader context, who can marry? An older guy can marry. A successful guy with money can marry a child. The parents might really, especially after a war, they might need that money, the bride price. So these situations endanger and really destabilize female and male youth. And when they do that, they destabilize society. And I think that what has happened is that there are these expectations that are in Africa and elsewhere for manhood. and womanhood that are impossible to reach in today's world. And I think that one thing that international actors can do is to have these conversations, because I don't think parents, older generation people think what we really want to do is ruin our youth and make them all look feel humiliated and so on. But that's what's going on, and we need to have those conversations badly.
You know, you talked about masculinity manifesting itself in a lot of different ways, and you said, you know, violence or the allure to engaging in violent acts or participating or joining violent gangs or groups is in one way for men and boys to recapture that masculine identity. And I think we all agree, being peace builders here, that that would be a negative form or expression of masculinity. What about the other side of that coin, positive expressions or forms of masculinity? I'd love to hear your thoughts on what are some examples of that, and then turn to femininity, because I think there's a lot of conversation around positive and negative forms of masculinity, but I at least haven't been part of or heard a lot of conversation around positive and negative forms of femininity. Mm-hmm. So what are some positive forms of masculinity?
Well, I find it interesting that we're talking about sort of dualities here, good and bad. You're looking at gender in a very moralistic way, Darren. And I think in the everyday life that people have, that's a challenge. And also, morality kind of has a different look in a war. What's right and what's wrong? Well, who the heck knows? Quite often, it's not what we think of from the outside, and I think these issues come to play. This issue of morality comes to play, I think, from observers, because we watch a lot of movies, we read a lot of books about the good guy and the bad guy, and even in a movie, you know, the bad guys wear black, for example. So you know, let's be sure who the bad guys are. So the idea of a negative masculinity, I think, comes out of this issue of expressing your manhood through violence, which is often, as I said, tied to masculinity or threatened masculinity, or traditions that kind of lock males into kind of a very destructive way of behaving and of seeing yourself. It's pretty one-dimensional, really, these ideas of masculinity, that where you have to, you know, you have to keep your emotions contained, and but often violence is excusable if it's in, you know, if your manhood is challenged or whatever, asserting your dominance or whatever it is. So I think that's not just negative, but sort of, you know, containing. If you take away the violent aspects, it also is a kind of a small way of thinking about what a male human being can be. So I think for both, positive ways of thinking about gender is where they break down those barriers, and I think we're seeing that very much so when we see women as politicians, women as athletes. Then we see a real expansion of opportunity and ideas and ways of thinking about what it is to be a woman, what it is to be female. And I think that that's all to the good and all encouraging. Now, what about guys? It's happening as well, you know. Fatherhood is a beautiful thing. And when men can share that, express that, venerate that, and they do, but when that's treasured more as part of the masculine identity, then that can be something positive as well. So I think the binary ideas that you're presenting are a little bit challenging, especially if we think about war and peace. Because, you know, in a war, the world is different.
Say more on that. In a war, the world is different. What I'm hearing is that our sense of morality or ethics as we sit in this room in the United States Institute of Peace in Washington, D.C., sipping our coffee and water, is one way. But the minute we're put in a situation where our lives are at risk, our families' lives are at risk, people are dying or being killed all around us. We need to think about those ethics or that morality differently, or we're forced to think about that ethics or morality differently?
Well, let me mention two things. One is we can think intellectually about war as much as we want, but you know, the Sierra Leoneans have a very poetic way of talking about these things, and often they'll talk about you know, the Civil War was going on, but the way they'll tell it in their own stories is when the war came to us. In other words, when it came to your neighborhood or it came to your village, that's when the war started for you personally. And quite often when that happens, when there was a rebel attack, for example, your character is revealed in ways that are usually, you know, not very encouraging. And it's – you run away. Sometimes you leave family members. You're just absolutely terrified. And, you know, if you're a refugee after that, that's hard to live with. Now, there's plenty of people who, even in this time of, you know, where you could be killed immediately, instantly, people do go back. People do risk their lives to go back. And you know, not everybody gets away. If you're an old person, if you have, if you're crippled, you're not going anywhere. So not, you know, refugees or IDPs, internally displaced, are only the ones who can move. And there's a lot who can't. So there's that revealer of character, which can be really troubling. And I think in terms of one's own personal morality, personal sense of self, it can be tough.
Yeah.
Another part of it is, you know, we have these kind of pristine ideas of things like child protection. Well, let me tell you a story from Eastern Congo. There was a woman, I heard about this secondhand, who was explaining what she did for her son. Her son was about 10. She was in this area surrounded by militias in Eastern DRC. So she made a protection strategy that only makes sense in a war zone. She went around finding out which was the nicest of the commanders, which was the nicest to children, and of the five militiamen leaders, you know, commanders in the area. And when she got that information, she took her son to that commander and said, "Please take my boy." Now, from the outside, this looks crazy. How could this be child protection? Here's a mother taking her son and saying, "Please take him to my 10-year-old to be a child soldier." But she knew he was going to be captured. She couldn't protect him. And so she went, and as they say in Central Africa, she did her analysis. And after she did her analysis, that was her child protection strategy. So that kind of thing is a classic example of how this issue of child protection that we treasure properly changes dramatically in a war zone.
Wow. So I want to talk a bit about hip-hop. You mentioned when you were here that hip-hop artists, you know, viewing them as influential leading voices for youth around the world. And in fact, I was just yesterday at the National Museum of African American History and Culture, which is an amazing addition to the National Mall.
You bet.
Just unbelievable. And one thing that I took a picture of there, put it on Instagram, was this huge banner, Public Enemy banner. And I grew up listening to Public Enemy, Chuck D, Flavor Flav, Terminator X, and loved their music. And you know, the language next to the banner said that, you know, Chuck D said that hip hop was CNN, the CNN for black people, because their stories or what was happening in their communities, analysis of that, expression of that, is not being picked up in the mainstream media, but hip hop culture. And hip-hop music was a way to do that. And it made me think about this interview that we were going to do today, you know, how you've seen hip-hop in other parts of the world. So not just the United States, but throughout Africa. And what are some examples of hip-hop artists that you think could be or are key drivers of peace in conflict zones? Or are maybe not necessarily key drivers of peace. I think that's a key thing I'm interested in, but also just an outlet for the views, stories, and expression of young people as they exist in those conflict zones.
Okay, so your latter question is the more authentic one for young people. And I think without question, in terms of hip-hop, the most influential in war, post-war zones going back a very long way is Tupac, and rightly so. Tupac has had his influence is still around in some places. He's still looked to, venerated by, I understand, among youth in Palestine, youth in Sierra Leone still hold on to Tupac to some degree. But going back in the 90s and the 2000s, there was no one more influential with young people in war, post-war. In terms of rappers, the other one would be Bob Marley, but you asked me about rappers. And Tupac, personally, I mean, I think he's one of the great musicians of, you know, who's ever come out of the United States. And what Tupac did, having listened to a lot of his music and talked a lot about Tupac with young people in sort of war, post-war environments. What he did is I think what really appealed to people the most is he was so authentic. He was so honest about what he was afraid of, what he was angry about, who was after him. And there was also an identification in Sierra Leone, for example. A lot of the guys would say that Tupac fought in the American War. And so there was an identification that he was like them. But Tupac was so honest with people. And so again, the good, bad side of Tupac, well, he's a human being growing up in an extremely tough situation. Talking about, having a song like All Eyes on Me or Hit 'Em Up, which is one of the scariest songs I've ever heard. At the same time, another song that's so important for people is Keep Your Head Up. Mm-hmm. So, when you're feeling down, Keep Your Head Up is a great song to listen to, and people do that. His influence has really waned over the years. I know that in 2011, the most popular hip-hopper in Juba, in South Sudan, was 50 Cent, and he was emblematic of the gangs. They have some really very scary gangs in that city. And Get Rich or Die Tryin', you could see the movie, you could see the video, you could hear the song in almost basically all over the city. It was 50 Cent land, and it was the interpretation was that it was that's what life was all about, get rich or die trying. Mm-hmm. So the influence is really powerful, and it isn't necessarily positive or negative. It's kind of both. But I think a great artist like Tupac really brings home all sorts of ideas about what it is to be a young person surrounded by violence. Mm-hmm.
Well, Mark,
he was a great artist.
Yeah, you were. And we just, I think a couple of weeks ago, it was the anniversary of his death, so we recognized
as far as we know.
Yeah, right. Machiavelli, you never know. Brother could come back, which would be awesome. So we're coming to the end of our show, and you've really helped us think anew about a lot of things, gender binary, ethics and morality as it pertains to lives who are experiencing violence and conflict, hip-hop and the role of hip-hop artists, all these things. So I want to thank you for that. But I want to make sure we have time to talk about the framework that you present in your book with all this information, all these stories and perspectives coming from young people that you've spoken with. What kind of impact can this have on people who are doing development work, peace-building work, working in conflict zones so that those programs can be more inclusive of young voices, young men and women in this work?
Well, I think quickly, we don't have a lot of time. One thing is stop focusing so much on elites. Don't ever assume that a well-educated elite youth is going to be representative of the non-elite majority, because they usually have very different priorities, very different perspectives. It's not that either side is right or wrong. This isn't about right or wrong. It's about it's the non-elites that are the majority and the non-elites that are overlooked. I mean, nobody cares about a female youth, generally speaking, and that just shouldn't be. So there's that dimension. I find that we have this overwhelming focus on programs, and I think we need to think twice about that, because programs just reach so few people. You know, a big program is going to reach 0.001% of all youth in a country, if it's a big one. So I think we need to focus much more on policies and practices in societies that exclude young people, and to talk about those with governments and others to reverse those. That the key is inclusion, and to try to make more young people feel that they belong. And that happens with policies, because policies impact many more people. So those are the kind of the main issues maybe that I'd like to leave. If your listeners read the book, then there's more in the framework.
Yes, you should certainly read the book. And again, the title is The Outcast Majority, War, Development, and Youth in Africa. And yes, you can find it online, any online bookstore. You can be able to get your hands on it. Our guest on today's show has been Mark Summers. He's a visiting researcher at the African Studies Center at Boston University. He's an internationally recognized expert on youth concerns in war and post-war countries, and the author of his most recent book entitled The Outcast Majority, War, Development, and Youth in Africa, published by the University of Georgia Press. Mark, thanks so much for being on the podcast today.
Great to be here, Darren. Thank you.
And this has been a dream of mine. I mentioned this to you when you were here for your book talk. I've been using your work in a class that I teach at American University for many years. It's always been a favorite of mine and of students. So to actually meet you in person, spend an hour with you has been really a real gift. The Peace Frequency is produced by the Global Campus, USIP's online learning platform designed to teach and learn critical peace-building skills through distance learning, a growing multimedia library of peace-building resources, and virtual live events just like this one. You can learn more about the Global Campus at usipglobalcampus.org. Our sound engineer and theme music composer is Timothy O'Keefe. Our graphic designer is Manuel Leon. And I've been your host, Darren Cambridge. Thanks to all of you who are listening today. Be sure to check the Peace Frequency website to access a recording of this show and other archived episodes of the podcast. The URL is usipglobalcampus.org/peace-frequency. Until next time, keep learning, supporting, and building peace.